This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
One of the motives of this project is to both get at what I find to be, now having spent the last 20-odd years, both spending more of my time looking at, say, contemporary neuroscience and 20th century philosophy than any other part of literary practice other than contemporary poetry. And one of the peculiarities is the allergy that has developed in literary study to the characterization of literary work as empiricist. Now, I entirely understand it in as much as a certain brand of empiricism became dominant and was highly reductive and seemed to dismiss much of literary practice as... So the one, say, for instance, gross example of this, which I actually quote at some point in the paper I sent out for tomorrow, somebody who is, in fact, much more varied and ambitious than this would suggest, but famously, I. Richards, in the mid-1920s, makes these claims about contrasting scientific and literary or poetic language and the use of language in these different domains, and says, well, literary language is emotive and it is basically meaningless. And this is a catastrophic kind of claim, but given that claim being made within a largely empiricist framework, it therefore seemed that empiricism is just simply not for literary interpretive study. So the real motivation, a large part of the motivation of this project, has been to uncover an alternative history of empiricism and empiricist practice that contrasts with what Whitehead called rigid empiricism, which is the dominant form and continues to be, and which I call the contrasting form, I call robust empiricism, and which is partly in order not to call it radical empiricism, which is James's term for his version of it and his theorizing of it. And I choose not to go with his name for it because I don't think this is a merely Jamesian branding. Even though I think he is absolutely central to this set of practices. And I also, the second reason I don't go with the name radical empiricism is because, like so many names, it has been abused. So very quickly after he was dead, and in fact, basically as soon as Whitehead was out of the picture, radical empiricism was shifted in analytic philosophy from basically how James understood it, which was either you could think of it as a critique of Hume, of Humean empiricism, or you could think of it as a correction of Humean empiricism. But what it was not was an extension of Humean empiricism. But in fact, the phrase radical empiricism was taken up within analytic philosophy to describe the radical empiricism of Hume. So the term for that reason as well is just less helpful. So I chose just to find a phrasing that, in fact, has not been used before in any context that I'm familiar with, and so it doesn't have a history, and that, in this instance, is a useful thing. Okay. One of the things that this is so exciting about this project is that the kind of empiricist practices that are involved here are precisely practices that are interested and engaged with interest. In other words, things we can't actually necessarily say very much about. We just feel a certain thing, and it's a certain kind of knowing that's involved. And these practices enable one actually to dig deeper without being unmasking practices. Okay, it's not that kind of digging deeper. Okay, so I'm fine if you say, I don't know why I'm here, I'm just here. Good. Before I forget, I should give everybody, I Xeroxed enough copies, I think, so each of you can have one. This is a poster from a recent conversation with Stengers in Canada. it's just to give you an idea. And I know the talk she gave was streamed live, and I know it'll be available. It may already be available online. She doesn't like to give talks in English because although her English is completely fluent, she doesn't like the way she sounds. But it's a really good talk. So when it's up there, you'll enjoy it. So I'm going to start this first. It's in four parts, and the first is called Whitehead and Russell. I'm going to start. And so the way we're going to do this, right, is I'm going to. And then if Jean-Michel has something he wants to ask about or talk about, he can. And then it'll be, and then it'll be open to everybody. I didn't want to just present for 50 minutes or an hour. By then, everybody would lose all the thoughts you had along the way, and I want to hear them. I'm here to hear you as much as I was here in order to put this together, which is part of my motivation. So I'm going to start with a pair of contrasts, really a pair of anecdotes, riddles explaining each other. First, a recollection of Bertrand Russell's, sometime after Whitehead's death, of something Whitehead had said to him long before, and of his own reaction. In the passage in question, in the fifth of a sequence of six autobiographical essays, Russell is recalling how, quote, "For some years, after throwing over Hegel, I had an optimistic riot of opposite beliefs. I thought that whatever Hegel had denied must be true. He had maintained that there is no absolute truth. The nearest approach, so he maintained, to absolute truth is truth about the absolute. But even that is not quite true because it unduly separates subject and object. Consequently, I, in rebellion, maintained that there are innumerable absolute truths, more particularly in mathematics. Hegel had maintained that all separateness is illusory. And this is that claim is absolutely central to a lot of what's going to follow variously, and though as you'll see, I am determined not to identify Hegel with Whitehead, and that the universe, this is Hegel still, is more like a pot of treacle than a heap of shot. I therefore said the universe is exactly like a heap of shot. Hegel had professed to prove by logic that number, space, time, and matter are illusions, but I developed a new logic which enabled me to think that these things were as real as any mathematician could wish. I read a paper to a philosopher, there's much more behind all this than what he's saying, but it's a nice summary of a particular spin on what he was doing. And I read a paper to a philosophical congress in Paris in 1900 in which I argued that there really are points and instance. Russell then notes, it was Whitehead who was the serpent in this paradise of Mediterranean clarity. He said to me once, this is the fine riddle, quote, you think the world is what it looks like in fine weather at noon day. I think it is what it seems like in the early morning when one first wakes from deep sleep, close quote. But I'm still, that was Russell quoting Whitehead, I'm still quoting Russell. I thought his remark horrid, but could not see how to prove that my bias was any better than his. At last he showed me how to apply the technique of mathematical logic to his vague and higgledy-piggledy world. Russell refers here to Whitehead's method of extensive abstraction, the first stirrings of which may be found in the discussion of the theory of interpoints in Whitehead's great 1905 memoir on mathematical concepts of the material world, a work that was truly, unlike Hume, truly fell dead, not to be read by almost anybody. Not that I am the first reader of it. In fact, I haven't read it. I've only glanced at it. It's incredibly beautiful. And thus, Russell continues, how, quote, okay, so this is, he's just saying, I found out how to apply this technique from Whitehead, and it's the technique that Russell ran with and became famous with and created analytic philosophy with, but it's Whitehead's technique, it's not Russell's. I found out how to use this technique from Whitehead. Then he continues, and thus how to dress it up, that is, this naked truth, in Sunday clothes that the mathematician could view without being shocked. This technique, which I learned from him, delighted me, and I no longer demanded that the naked truth should be as good as the truth in its mathematical Sunday best. Close quote. In response to an inquiring reader, Russell subsequently explained that, quote, another way of expressing the difference between Whitehead and me is that he thought the world was like jelly, and I thought it was like a heap of shot. In neither case was this a deliberate opinion, but only an imaginative picture. Close quote. In substituting jelly for a pot of treacle, the first comparison, Russell confirms his association of Whitehead with Hegel, having observed in a prior essay in the same collection of Portraits from Memory that Hegel's universe, insofar it was conceived by Hegel as a, quote, closely knit unity, was like a jelly in the fact that if you touched any one part of it, the whole quivered, close quote. Russell hastened to add that still it was, quote, unlike a jelly in the fact that it could not really be cut up into parts, close quote. The association of Whitehead and Hegel is quite common, indeed almost common sense. Hegel ostensibly being the first process philosopher, Whitehead the greatest among 20th century process philosophers, including Bergson. It is a thoroughly misleading association, however. Whatever Hegel may suppose, Whitehead certainly doesn't think the world to be anything like jelly or a pot of treacle when he identifies reality with a very precise sort of appearance, namely what it seems like in the initial moments of waking from deep sleep. In the discussion of his early, quote, revolt against Hegel, Russell observed that, quote, if you watch a bus approaching you during a bad London fog, I hope you've all had that experience, and you see first a vague blur of extra darkness, and you only gradually become aware of it as a vehicle with parts and passengers. According to Hegel, he added, your first view as a vague blur is more correct than your later impression, which is inspired by the misleading impulses of the analytic intellect. Like the philosophers of ancient Greece, Russell continues, I prefer sharp outlines and definite separations, such as the landscapes of Greece afford. Close quote. Russell's Hegel here is sharply Bergsonian, insofar as the misleading impulses of the analytic intellect are exemplified in the way one spatializes an approaching London bus. And he insisted that Whitehead, quote, was considerably influenced by Bergson as well. This is quite true, but not in the manner or to the extent Russell supposed. Certainly, it is more truly said of Bergson than of Whitehead that he believed the world to be a jelly, albeit of a fairly liquefied sort. So that's the first anecdote and the first contrast. The world is what it looks like in fine weather at noonday. It is what it seems like in the early morning when one first wakes from deep sleep. And here is the second, very, very famous in Anglo-American philosophical circles, the first being renowned only among the much smaller group of those who find themselves obliged to take Whitehead seriously. It is again a statement by Whitehead, 30, 35 years after the earlier one. The Harvard Philosophy Department had invited Russell to deliver the 1940 William James Lectures, published as an inquiry into meaning and truth, and Whitehead, recently retired from the department where he had been the leading light for a dozen years, was introducing his old friend. The one Englishman who somehow turned into a major American philosopher, even though he only visited the U.S. for the first time at the age of 61, and then only for a fortnight, before moving permanently and unexpectedly 2 years later. This isn't just my impression, right, that it's unexpected and that he became an American philosopher. It extends from Max Frisch's influential 1951 anthology, Classic American Philosophers, Peirce, James, Royce, Santayana, Dewey, Whitehead, to the 2004 Blackwell Guide to American Philosophy and the 2008 Oxford Handbook of American Philosophy, both of which contain chapters on Whitehead, and both of which, I'll note, are British imprints. So in 1940, with London and the rest of Europe lost in the fog of war, the one somehow Americanized Englishman introduces the other, somewhat less so, the one who, after the war, will be awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature, as Bergson, who will die in Paris some months hence, had been honored in 1927. And this is how the introduction goes, at least the line that has been burned into philosophical memory. Quote, "Bertie thinks I am muddled-headed, but then I think that he is simple-minded." Close quote. Okay. That's every walking analytical philosopher will know that. Hi. As with everything Whitehead says, one has to attend carefully. It may seem as if he is simply establishing a dichotomy. There are those who are simple-minded, and there are those who are muddle-headed, with Bertie falling into the former class, and Alty, as he was known to friends and family, into the latter. But this is not what Whitehead is saying. For if he is muddle-headed, it is only to someone who is simple-minded. In the same way, a sense of the world as being what it seems to be like as one wakes from deep sleep is only horrifying, I thought his remark horrid, to someone who wants the world to be, in itself, perfectly clear. Whitehead is not describing himself as muddle-headed. Rather, he is describing how he appears to someone who, like Russell, is temperamentally inclined to reduce complexes to simples, who strives for clarity when there may be none, or more exactly, from Whitehead's perspective, when any clarity that is achieved, and he certainly regards it as an achievement, must be regarded as an abstraction from a more primitive lack of clarity. As I've already hinted, when Whitehead proposes that for him the world is what it seems like in the early morning when one first awakes from deep sleep, as Russell recalled Whitehead's proposition, he is suggesting that he shares something with William James, if not with Russell. You recall the lectures Russell was to deliver were named for James. Namely, a sense of appearance as being, in certain circumstances, coterminous with reality. In this, Whitehead and James contrast with Russell's neutral monism, a perspective Russell famously and misleadingly claimed he shared with James, as well as with the absolute idealist monism of F.H. Bradley, whose masterpiece, Appearance and Reality, was both, as I assume everyone knows but bears repeating, the subject of T.S. Eliot's Harvard dissertation and the object of much careful study by Russell, James, and Whitehead, who titled his own masterwork so as to contrast directly with Bradley's Process and Reality instead of Appearance and Reality. It is not that appearance in general is the same as reality in general. Rather, for both James and Whitehead, though certainly not for Russell, a particular form of confusion of things being confused, fused with one another, that is to say, of exhibiting a state of inextricable togetherness, is characteristic of waking from deep sleep, as well as of reality as such. So in the following remarks, I'll be unpacking some of the consequences of this shared understanding of Whitehead and James, which Russell was not privy to, which, as Jean-Michel has mentioned, I'm investigating in a study titled Robust Empiricism's Jamesian Modernism Between the Disciplines, 1878 to the Present. So the presentation will take the form, as you've heard, of what you've heard, plus three additional approximately 10-minute installments. So now we can discuss, and I'll just tell you so you know what to look forward to, sort of, is that the topics of the installments to come, you've now heard the installment that was, will be respectively speculative and critical philosophy in relation to theory. That's the first. Togetherness, pure and simple. That's the second. And then some mix of so-called indication and so-called cosmopolitics. So I'm sure there are questions. Whether there are questions you can articulate yet, I remember I'll just tell you. Jean-Michel knows because what the talk he heard at MSA was a talk about Deleuze and Harold Bloom. Recently I discovered a way to talk about the two of them together, which I'd never realized was possible. But I remember when I was a grad student and taking a class with Bloom, and I loved Bloom then, and I still love him. But he was a rather difficult person to talk with because he seemed brilliant in a certain kind of way that made it very hard for one to have a conversation with him. So I discovered, and I still operate on this way, not with people perhaps of less perfect brilliance than him. I would have a question that would come up in my mind in class. I wouldn't ask it. I'd have another question somehow related to that. I didn't know how. I didn't ask it. And finally, I had a question comment the third time around, and then it was interesting. Then I was actually able to engage him in a way that I didn't feel was humiliating. Now, I don't want to put it that way so you think, oh, my God, you've got to do that here. But I just want to let you know.
It's not really a question. It's perhaps more something to help everybody understand your beginning. I love this anecdote that for me calls up the famous definition given by Lacan of the unconscious, Baltimore in the early morning, waking up. But it's more this term that is a little an embarrassment, I think, that you mentioned here and there that you see with Hegel, you see with Bradley, which is that of the absolute. I don't want you to say what is the absolute, but this genealogy of a term that is really so important for Hegel, the Romantics, and so on, as something that one has a sort of vague impression was simply destroyed by Russell. And you're saying that maybe not, that there is some consideration, perhaps out of respect for Whitehead, for a certain notion of the absolute in Russell's atomism. Or anyway, to help us use or simply discard that term of the absolute.
The absolute. So are you asking whether this suggests that Russell retained some attraction to the absolute, or are you saying that Whitehead may have kept
or in
it?
Your critical discourse, yeah. Whether you waste a lot of time explaining to students the genealogy of that term, or you quickly discard it, whether you make use of it or not?
I don't make particular use of it, but one of the, and I'll say more about that as we go along, but one of the quite astonishing things about, I should say that what I'm doing here in setting up Russell and Whitehead, and it's actually a much more complex set of terms between them and James, is to this very strange thing that happens. James dies before he finishes his work. He knows he's dying for several years before he actually does, and so he's been gradually getting himself to a point when he might be able to do something that wasn't his native gift, which is to in fact describe an adequate metaphysics. He's not a systematic thinker, he was a provocateur in lots of ways. This wasn't the thing, but he was going to die, so he made an extraordinary effort and wrote a great book, which has been very rarely read. Many of his books are widely read, but his last unfinished work called Some Problems of Philosophy is not much read. It's a beautiful book, but it's not finished. And at the end of it, there is a sort of little epilogue of some notes that the compiler of the book found and James writes, and this is very late, months before he dies, and he writes and he says that basically he's been constructing an arch. You've now seen the masterful arch in St. Louis. And that he's been constructing, but he's only kind of half finished it. But his philosophy, his his sense of what's possible is that you hold out the hope that there will be somebody to finish your work. So you can die without it being tragic, as it were. And so he said, he describes how, you know, he expects somebody to continue the work that he has not been able to finish. And my claim, and I make it more strongly than other people do, but it's not wholly original to me, is that Whitehead came along and finished the arch, not an arch. And now, what makes this so utterly weird is that throughout, a large focus in this last work of James's is why somebody like Russell can't be right. And that whole decade, which James died in 1910, that whole first decade of the 20th century, Whitehead and Russell spent unbelievable amounts of energy putting together their joint masterpiece, Principia Mathematica, which is a work that, whatever problems there are with it, we don't have the world we live in without that work. Computer technology requires the kind of exploration and investigation that they put in place and made possible in that work. The people who, in the 1950s and 40s, who are the founding figures of American technological work in computer science, all were avid readers of Principia Mathematica. And so it's a work that, although none of us in the humanities are in any way equipped to read, maybe there's a few, but I'm not. So the point is that the last person that James could ever have expected to come to his rescue was Russell's collaborator, Russell's chief collaborator. It's just one of the strangest things in intellectual history. So, setting up this whole thing, I'm actually trying to set up the three of them. Here, I'm just sort of doing it with the two. So, James, much more firmly than Whitehead, is fighting absolute idealism. But just like Whitehead, it's a battle, and I'll talk about it a little bit here, with friends. It's a very different kind of battle than we're used to. And the reason the Harvard Philosophy Department was so great, much greater than it was, say, for instance, in the more recent flowering in the 60s and 70s, and much greater than it was under Quine, is because it was a place with very different opinions flourished. People who did not agree with each other, but were happy to disagree. And that's a very unusual situation. It's not how intellectual... And it's the sort of thing that actually, it's one reason why Whitehead decided he had to go there. Even though James was long dead, was because Whitehead was a great believer in civilization, and that's a term which has gotten a lot of knocks in our culture. But the kind of civilizing possibilities of people who disagree but can talk to each other with pleasure, that's what he means by civilization. And that's, in some ways, the model for multiculturalism. But it's a difficult thing to achieve when you don't like the term civilization, to actually make multiculturalism work when you don't have a civilizing impulse within it. So that's one. And so Stenger's right now is actually very keen on recovering the advantages. Okay. Okay. So this is now part two. This is Whitehead's speculative philosophy and critical theory. I'm trying to be provocative here. I may not be provocative enough, but I'm trying to be. Theory, as it has been, and I know this is a conversation in advanced theory, so I'm trying to give you something that you may not have heard here before. Theory, as it has been practiced in humanities departments in the U.S. the past 30 years, has been chiefly critical in nature. It's not that it is without a speculative aspect. It's just that the speculative component hasn't been much talked about. We have a journal called Critical Inquiry. We talk about critique. and we want our students to learn to think critically. It's true that the oldest continuous philosophical journal in the U.S., which published very important early work by James and Peirce, and was originally published in St. Louis by the so-called St. Louis Hegelians, is titled The Journal of Speculative Philosophy. Although it is surely to be congratulated for its Catholicism, lowercase, James was about as anti-Hegelian as you can get, and Peirce was much more Kantian than Hegelian, no less surely the name will strike most of us as hopelessly outdated. Are you really going to publish your essay on Whitehead in something called the Journal of Speculative Philosophy? Okay, fine, you do it. Right? Speculative philosophy, Hegelian or not, seems like a thing safely buried in the past, and maybe better left buried in the past. Right? What the phrase expressly does not do, as a phrase, is exactly what Whitehead's speculative philosophy, according to Isabel Stengers, is designed to account for, namely the way propositions, right? Whether it's Whitehead's proposition to Russell, you know, this is what you are like, this is what I'm like. The way propositions, the heart and soul of theory, when Whitehead in Process and Reality gives us his theory of propositions, proposition is synonym for him with theory. Okay? The way propositions, the heart and soul of theory, critical or otherwise, serve as what Whitehead terms lures for feeling. So what I'm suggesting here is, by and large, we don't talk about it, that side of theory. Now, we just talk about the critical side of theory. Another way of putting this is that insofar as critique or criticism possesses interest, it is because it feeds our speculative concerns, our uncertainties. I don't know, so I speculate. I venture, I adventure. Right? I remember being puzzled as an undergrad who was sufficiently exercised by the new literary criticism and theory I was exposed to in my first couple of years in college in the late 70s, that I devised an independent concentration in criticism and theory. I remember being puzzled at the ease with which any rhetorically astute critic or theorist could bring me round to their way of thinking, at least for the moment. This puzzled me because the only language I had then was the language of belief, and it seemed that I was at the mercy of whomever I happened to be reading, believing one thing, then upon reading a new critic, finding myself no less believing the opposite. Maybe this had never happened to anybody else, but it was happening to me all the time. I now suspect, however, that my confusion was mostly due to my limited vocabulary. I'm not a Rortian in many senses, but in one, I don't reduce everything to vocabulary. But I think the problem here was my vocabulary. The skeptical vocabulary of critique that dominates much theory with a continental twist, no less than it dominates the discourse of analytic philosophy. What you find yourself believing is either true or it is false. It is either the way things are or it is an illusion. In all likelihood, it is the latter, false, illusory. But of course, in order for the critique to have any effect, there has to be someone who believes it. And what better person than the college student, a welter of conflicting beliefs anyway? Kant said that we now live in an age of criticism. To be sure, he said this 250 years ago. But if anything, the claim is stronger today. No doubt he was provoked into making this proposition, which again is what it is, and it has had a long life, as into making so many others, by the ur-critic of the day, the ur-skeptic, Mr. David Hume. We don't actually know anything about causation. We just know that things are constantly conjoined. That's Hume. First I believe this, then I believe that. What I'd like to suggest, though, is that this wasn't the case. It's just what I thought was so. I'm not accusing myself at 20 of being deluded, right, what I thought was so. It's easy enough to do that. But the age of criticism had deprived me of a certain self-awareness, of the capacity not just to think speculatively, but to think about speculative thought, to take speculation seriously. In point of fact, I wasn't believing Lacan and then believing Leavis, and I wasn't disbelieving them either. I was interested. Their propositions were functioning well as lures for feeling. What was happening was that I was confusing the intensity of my feelings, the intensity of my interest, for passing beliefs. It's not that I didn't have beliefs. It's just that it was awfully hard to figure out what they were, because I only possessed the language of critique. So I really had no idea how to talk about the speculative aspects of the material I was reading with such relish. Leavis and Lacan, Hume and Paul de Man. Here I could talk about Kant's understanding of philosophy as criticism, critical philosophy, which investigates the faculty of reason in respect of all its pure a priori knowledge, and of the metaphysics of nature as corresponding to the speculative employment of pure reason, that is to say, speculative philosophy, by contrast with the practical employment of pure reason. In other words, the principles of pure reason employed in the theoretical knowledge of all things by contrast with a priori principles which determine and make necessary all our actions. Okay? And then map. So that's a quick, intense description of how Kant might be said to have seen the relation between speculative philosophy, critical philosophy, and then something else, a kind of practical philosophy. I could do that and spend the rest of our time and the rest of the week, and then map how, by assorted twists and turns, these concepts of critical and speculative philosophy reached Whitehead, and others, such as C.D. Broad, a former student of Whitehead's, an important Cambridge philosopher in his own right, who published a famous essay in 1924 on critical and speculative philosophy. Broad didn't mean by these terms what Whitehead would come to mean, however. Whitehead, who the same year was moving his base of operations from London to Cambridge, Mass., and his base of concerns from philosophy of science to metaphysics and what he chose to call speculative philosophy. Part one of Process and Reality, great book, do read it, published in 1929, you'll spend years, you'll enjoy it, is titled The Speculative Scheme. Chapter one is called Speculative Philosophy, so it's all right up there up front. You can't open the book without seeing this is what's going on, which is why almost everybody closes it, because we're finished with speculative philosophy, unless it's Hegel. Okay? Big mistake, I think. Huge mistake. Enormous consequences. Most of them not good. Obviously, I don't have the time to do anything like this, give you this full accounting of how speculative philosophy and Kant turned into speculative philosophy in Whitehead. But it will probably suffice to give you a taste, at least, of what happened between Kant and Whitehead. And James plays an enormous role here in this transference. To hear that in Process and Reality, Whitehead suggests that instead of writing a critique of pure reason, right, everybody knows that phrase, Kant should have written a critique of pure feeling. A critique of pure feeling. This indeed is what Whitehead proposes he is doing in his essay in Cosmology. Something happened to speculative philosophy as it moved from the Kantian endeavor to the subsequent Jamesian Whiteheadian one, and it is not the same thing that happens when it moves from Kant to Hegel. Obviously, Hegelian speculative philosophy is not Kantian. Different things happen. The difference, as I propose in my study of Jamesian modernism, is the difference between starting a natural-born rationalist, as Kant, being a continental philosopher of the 18th century, certainly was, and being shocked into something else, some strange hybrid through exposure to British empiricism in the form of Hume's critical genius, and that's Kant, and starting as a natural-born empiricist. This was the birthright of Englishmen of the 19th century, like Whitehead, and American Englishmen, Anglo-Americans, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, like James, 19th century men of Anglo-Saxon stock who grew into their intelligence in a newly Darwinized world. And then were further shocked, so that the Darwin was shock enough, and then were further shocked by exposure not to any one figure. There was no Hume to wake them from their slumbers, and obviously that's a different kind of being woken from one's slumbers than Whitehead is talking about. But in Whitehead's case, through exposure to the astonishing rationalist adventures of mathematics in the mid-19th century, okay, I realized what Whitehead was up to when I spent a couple of years trying to get a sense of what was happening in the mid-19th century in math. That's not something which we in the humanities are usually encouraged to look into. Most mathematicians kind of know it, not really. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. And where James was concerned, his exposure to the hyper-rationalist psychology also emerging at the same time in the German states, in the name, to be sure, of empiricism. But this was, like the empiricism of Hume and that of Kant, who was only following Hume in this regard, a rigid empiricism. The psychology in Germany in the mid-19th century, very rigid, as was Kant's impression of what empiricism might be, having received it from Hume, who is Mr. Rigid personified, delightful person. But whereas philosophy is concerned, absolutely set in his ways. James and Whitehead were provoked as well, and no less strongly, by the natives. That is to say, homegrown absolute idealists, British and American, not just out in St. Louis among schoolmaster Hegelians, in a twist that Thomas Pynchon has never done anything with but would know what to do. The leader of the St. Louis Hegelians, William Torrey Harris, was at the same time U.S. Commissioner of Education. But among their closest intellectual peers, for James, Royce at Harvard. For Whitehead, McTaggart at Cambridge. And less close personally, but no less intimate on the page, Bradley at Oxford. Provoked by these absolute idealists, James and Whitehead developed a very different form of empiricism, a much more powerful one, I argue, which I term robust empiricism. So like Kant, James and Whitehead cross empiricism and rationalism. That's a contrast which, in fact, Kant invented in his way for him to order his predecessors. But they don't do so following Kant. Here are a couple of famous statements by James that describe how he felt, that describe how he at least felt about the matter. Quote, and these are lovely, and they are designed to make many people upset. He was extremely good at that. Whereas Whitehead was completely unwilling to upset anybody if he could avoid it. It's completely different personalities. Though if you read him carefully, he's even more upsetting. So this is James. Hume had no English successors of adequate ability to complete him and correct his negations, the stuff he got wrong. So it happened, as a matter of fact, that the building out of critical philosophy has mainly been left to thinkers who are under the influence of Kant. I believe that Kant bequeaths to us not one single conception which is both indispensable to philosophy and which philosophy either did not possess before him or was not destined inevitably to acquire after him through the growth of men's reflection upon the hypotheses by which science interprets nature. Close quote. Okay? However you want to read that, Kant is irrelevant. Not because he's not interesting, doesn't do good work, he's just not necessary. The philosopher of necessity is not necessary. These are fighting words. But really not so very different is Whitehead's no less famous decision to go to pre-Kantian philosophy, as he termed it, for support for his own novel concepts. That's what he does. He goes to Leibniz, he goes to Spinoza, he goes to Locke. He went reading them just to see what they might have to say, and he said, there's some pretty good ideas mixed in with a lot of confusion. All right, Kant, not so interested. Doesn't need him. Now, I should step back and say, and yes, Whitehead also says that when he was a young man, he knew most of Critique of Pure Reason by heart. So in terms of he didn't know Hegel at all. His friends knew Hegel. He wasn't interested in Hegel, and he said, for bad reason, he said. He didn't read Hegel because the first Hegel that he read was Hegel on logic, and it was just stupid. And so he said, that's what a young man does. You read something, you think somebody says something stupid, you say, forget it. I'm not interested. Okay. So he regrets it, but he doesn't really regret it. Okay. He got enough Hegel from his friends to know what he had to do in order not to be Hegel. Okay. In any case, instead of following Kant, James and Whitehead come at the task of crossing empiricism and rationalism, both from the very different philosophical backdrop, as I've suggested, but on top of that, they come to it with expressly scientific perspectives. Not as naive boosters of science, they are both no less critical of scientific self-understanding than they are of philosophical self-understanding. This is something that absolutely continues, especially with Stengers, although to Latour to a degree. But, and this is how they differ from Stengers and Latour, as major scientists themselves. Having played major roles in establishing major 20th century sciences, this is something that James is often credited with, even though people don't read him, don't read The Psychology. It's an amazing book. It hasn't aged a day since 1890, my opinion. But it is actually no less true of Whitehead, and for various reasons, that's much less apparent. There's a whole chapter in this project about why that happened to him, and I can answer questions if you like. But physiological psychology, where James is concerned, he single-handedly made it into the science it is today. The problem with the German version of it was that it was much too metaphysical, and the positivist version in France was much too metaphysical. And he saw a way to do this, which remained metaphysical, but not much too so. And Whitehead, the new mathematics and logic and physics. Kant had a fine training in science, but he was no major innovator. You have to go back to Leibniz to find a comparable figure. Even so, as I see it, it is not Whitehead or James separately who make the difference, but James and Whitehead together. Okay, that's the end of part two. Now, surely you have thoughts in addition to questions.
Definitions, you talked about critique in Kant's sense,
yep.
But earlier on when you were talking about your own experience as
That's
critical, I guess you used it in a more modern sense of
criticism, like
critical theory,
right.
Politics, or for instance the way I think Zizek has transformed Lacanian theory into critical theory.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do they overlap? Those two meanings somehow?
As I suggested, clearly Kant has a very technical sense of what's involved, and I think they overlap probably mostly to the extent that the earlier usages give credence, give a kind of stature to the more recent. So that, say, for instance, when Zizek is producing a critique, as you're saying, on the basis of a more even-handed combination of critique and speculation in the theoretical apparatus of Lacan, he relies strongly, on in being able to place himself in a long tradition from Hegel forward. And so it's not that he will necessarily mean the same thing as the Romantic Germans and the Enlightenment Germans did, but he's able to. And this is the thing that I'm only coming to realize about my own history, but I think it's all of our history, all of our shared history, because unless I'm wrong, we all grow up into an environment of critical theory, not speculative theory. And it means that lots of speculation takes place. Again, I'm suggesting that, in fact, that is primarily what interests us, what grabs us in the figures whom we are grabbed by and in the propositions that take us. It's the speculative quality rather than the merely or purely critical skeptical aspects. But the language of critique has made it hard to talk about that feature, and it means it's hard to critique Zizek adequately because we only do so on the terms of critique. Do you see what I'm saying? And so it's a complex, and by contrast, you have somebody like Whitehead who has been dropped like a hot potato on all sides. Everybody's equally responsible for that. He's the great unifier of analytic and continental philosophy. In that regard, and what distinguishes him from the other traditions, what is in fact genuinely novel, is the embrace of speculation and the insistence. And I'll, at the end, if I have time, I'll say something about, or I'll refer you all at least to an essay of Stenger's, which he does a fantastic job getting at what that involves. You can speak it into that so everybody can hear you.
Sure. I just also just a sort of definitional question, which I know can be very difficult, but yeah, I sort of have some sense when you say the word speculation, it sets off some set of neurons, but I'm not quite sure what exactly you want the term to do. So I was wondering if you could maybe unpack a bit more what speculation is, and then to make it, just so I understand the coordination of the mm-hmm. two, the beginning and the end of this part of it. You came from speculation into the end into the sort of grounding in the empirical mathematical sciences. And I'm wondering if you can also help me understand what you mean by speculation through the relationship of speculation to those empirical sciences.
Yeah, there's, why don't I, Stenger's is much better on this than I am on my feet. And so just to give you a sense of how that would work, she speaks in relation to Whitehead's speculative philosophy of the whole empirical side of speculative philosophy, okay, and what this involves. Whitehead has a range of categories that he invents. You can find precedents for some of them. You can find no precedents for others of them that he uses to devise his various accounts. And the empirical side of his speculative philosophy are ways that the ways that his speculative philosophy can, if it works, enlarge the imaginations of specialists in particular sciences. Okay, so the idea there is that. This is the way in which there's a very strong critical element in which Stenger's completely nails in Whitehead's general philosophy, which is not just speculative. He's got many different levels, which is a criticism of modern, chiefly 20th century, starting the 19th century, professionalism of the disciplines. Which he argues, and this is phrasing of his, makes minds run in grooves. And also has the consequence that the specific abstractions which are so productive within a special discipline, a special science, that allow one to do really interesting work, also can prevent one from doing more interesting work and from locating other abstractions and such. And so, in other words, one becomes unimaginative as a specialist. And so the critical side of philosophy and of his philosophy is designed to work with our abstractions. Okay, to revise our abstractions when necessary. Okay, and there's a whole thematics and a whole stream. And so that interest, that concern on his part, comes from his having been a practitioner. And so in that way, he is not unlike Latour. Not that Latour is a practitioner of the sciences he studies, but he studies the people in situ. And Whitehead, like James, are coming from very much in situ locations when they talk about science. Again, much, much more complex forms of science than Kant ever dreamed of. But that's I think, what is going on there. And how, so there's one of Stenger's students, a fellow named Didier Debez, writes about Whitehead's speculative empiricism. That's his phrase. It's very similar to what I call robust empiricism, but with a different set of emphases. And again, it's that capacity, but for an empiricism not to be rigid, it means it has to take speculation seriously, which is precisely what rigid empiricisms do not do, starting with Hume. Okay. Yes. Tell me back.
I don't know that my comment's worth a microphone, but I always remembered this comment. I thought it was Bertrand Russell who said something to the effect, show me someone with a continually open mind and I'll show you someone with nothing in their head. Meaning this notion, it's a terrible critique of speculative consciousness. And I think it's very destructive, as a matter of fact. But my question is what... I always think of it as kind of like an aesthetic that some people have and others don't. But you need to have a kind of a willingness to take enormous risk if you're going to live in a speculative environment and to entertain mm-hmm. possibility. Mm-hmm. And what do you think makes for that in terms of the reading that you're doing?
The willingness to take risks, or
and live with uncertainty and live with. Speculation.
Yeah, I mean, again, part of it, both James and Whitehead, and I'll go along with this, even though it's not entirely fashionable, is there are temperamental differences, and that is very much a matter of one's experience growing up. But it might help as well, just to give a little bit of concreteness here, because of what's involved and what is so striking. In Whitehead's account, and again, Stenger's nails it, is some of you will have heard the term prehension, which is one of Whitehead's terms of art, and it's basically a translation of that. He calls it positive feeling. Feeling. Positive prehension is equivalent to feeling. And now you understand what positive prehension is, although you don't quite understand it yet, because he allows for prehension to occur in all sorts of environments and under all sorts of conditions that most of us would not. It's a universe-wide. He's not a panpsychist by any means. So panpsychism, which is that there is a consciousness operating at all levels in the universe, he's not at all, but he does insist on the experience as occurring broadly, and not just within particular creatures, and certainly not just within humans. But the key element here is that there are two kinds of prehension. One of them is this positive sense, so just we can imagine it as simply as what it's like to feel something. And then there's what he calls negative prehension. And this has to do with the fact that in his account of the way things are, the only real things, this is part of his speculative philosophy, the only real things are what he calls actual occasions. What Stenger's article that I'll suggest to you is about why he doesn't allow for societies as being real things. And again, this needs to be elaborated because what he means by societies is much broader than we normally take it to be. So, for instance, each one of you is individually a society. And you in fact, are many societies, both because you are you who continue to be the same person who you were at the beginning of this talk, and you will probably be the same person when you leave this talk. Very rare that actually occurs. One has that transformative experience. But and certainly, even when it occurs, you usually think you are the same person. You are just the same and changed, as opposed to being utterly changed, right? In fact, none of us probably wants to be utterly changed, not just by any talk, but by anything, right? So the point is, that is one kind of society. But then you are also the cells in your physiology, how they function together. That's also societal for him. All enduring objects are societies for him. The chair you're sitting on is a society. But so is this temporary community in this room right now of human beings. Okay, many, many different ranges of in which societal formations occur for Whitehead, and but all societies of whatever sort, whether it's that chair, whether it's you, whether it's the bunch of us together, the societies that are formed are only formed out of actual occasions, at various levels of abstraction and so on and so forth. And that includes your friendly chair that is giving you a place to sit right now so you don't have to sit on the floor. And that is responding to you variously, not consciously, but that is nevertheless responding for Whitehead, although it's mostly within the frame of an encounter where you abstract the chair from that encounter just as you abstract yourself from that encounter. So it's again, the real story is much more complex than the apparently contradictory one. So the point is that every actual occasion for Whitehead prehends, that's that word, the whole universe. Now, this is one of the things that makes him seem like an absolute idealist. Only everything's absolute. It's the kind of, sounds just like Russell saying, well, no, there's not just one absolute. There's tons of absolutes. But the reason he's not an absolute idealist is because he doesn't just have a notion of positive prehensions. He also has a notion of negative prehensions, which is that in the course of taking in the universe that has existed up to this point, which each actual occasion does, you being the actual occasion in the process of formation, you reject an enormous amount of the universe. Now, why the reason this is relevant is because the whole point of Whitehead's speculative philosophy and how it may have an effect on empiricist practices is because it's designed to make you aware of the things that are being rejected. And the terms he uses here are basically along the lines of what something might have been but is not. And it's precisely that addition to what you can empirically think about and examine that makes it robust and makes empiricist practices more robust. And it's precisely when, say, for instance, a contemporary, let's go back a few words, a 1950s nuclear scientist refuses to think about these possibilities, what might have been but is not. And that makes the practice of the science hardens it and makes one beholden to one's abstractions in a way that can be very unhealthy. And one's not sufficiently critical of one's own abstractions. You see that? And so it's at that level where the speculative endeavor, which is the willingness to think about what is not the case, whereas Russell is always trying to get at what is the case. And after him, his acolyte Quine does so even more effectively. Because Russell is inconsistent. Russell just goes, he goes from one to the other. He's not he's an enthusiast. He's all Whitehead until he's all Wittgenstein, until he's all behaviorism, you know. He's moving from one to another, trying to get at this everything. But he's not the least bit interested in this potential. So that's how I don't know the quote, but it sounds like him. And he's brilliant. It's just that he's facile. Okay? So okay. So, togetherness. Is togetherness a technical philosophical term? Okay. Where Whitehead is concerned, it certainly is. But more surprising is that this isn't just an idiosyncratic usage, but the term itself seems to have developed out of the community of thought around Bradley at Cambridge in the 1890s. Certainly this is what the OED suggests, although there are no citations directly from Bradley himself. In one of the unusual oversights, they missed them. They're very famous, but they missed them. In a sense, this shouldn't be surprising, because as James insisted, and one of the nice things I'll just say in passing about writing about both James and Whitehead is I get to flip from one to the other. And they're not the same person, but they really complement each other beautifully. As James insisted when he was formulating what he called radical empiricism, he wished to take connection as seriously as rationalists do, while taking separation as seriously as empiricists. If empiricists have traditionally resisted regarding connectivity as being equally real as that which is connected, right? That was Hume's whole argument. Then his, James's, aim was to radicalize empiricism. It is therefore fitting that two prominent uses by James of togetherness, there's also an earlier use with regard to Hegel, occur in a 1905 essay on the thing and its relations. In a pair of passages cited from Appearance and Reality that James takes from in the course of one of his major criticisms of Bradley. But if the term togetherness, by contrast with the concept, right, the concept is perfectly, has been around, although not named as such perhaps, but has been around. If the term togetherness, by contrast with the concept, is of minor import where James is concerned, he's always talking about togetherness but never using the word, or rarely, it is fundamental for Whitehead. I'll just mention here that this is so obvious to Whitehead scholars that when the women's magazine McCall's, I don't know if anybody here remembers it, but which had adopted the slogan "The Magazine of Togetherness" in 1954, began suggesting that it had, quote, added a new word to the vocabulary, right? Congratulating itself for making togetherness into a household term. This provoked a backlash on the pages of Harper's, complete with highly abstract passages from Whitehead. He was dead by then, but a quite wonderful young Whitehead scholar came forward with this. The result, however, was a letter from the assistant publisher of McCall's to the editor of Harper's affirming that, quote, "The continuous identification and association with McCall's, the magazine of togetherness, as stated on each cover of our magazine, in our advertising and promotion, and even through such articles as yours, gives us the right to regard togetherness as something which cannot be used commercially without our permission," close quote. Okay, togetherness. No, you can't use togetherness without our permission. It's fantastic. There's an even more surprising story attached to a second term closely associated with togetherness in Whitehead's speculative philosophy, creativity. which it turns out he coined. And I'll be happy to fill in some of the details if anyone wishes. The challenge for Whitehead was to turn a rationalist, idealist term of art, togetherness, into a robust empiricist tool. In a sense, you might say, he succeeded all too well if a commercial enterprise like McCall's could use it as a basis for advertising and promotion. But that doesn't make it any less useful within the context of Whiteheadian speculative thought. I'm just going to give you one passage among many in Process and Reality where Whitehead discusses togetherness, and then two from observations by Isabel Stengers and Bruno Latour. These should give a sense of what is at stake. If there's time, I'll try to give some additional background in the final segment. So here's the Whitehead. Quote, water. There is a togetherness of the component elements in individual experience. This togetherness has the special, peculiar character of togetherness in experience. It is a togetherness of its own kind, explicable by reference to nothing else. For the purpose of this discussion, Whitehead continues, it is indifferent whether we speak of a stream of experience or of an occasion of experience. With the former alternative, there is togetherness in the stream. Okay? So just think of yourself 10 seconds ago and think of yourself right now and think of how you feel a certain togetherness with that experience you had just 10 seconds ago. All right? And with the latter alternative, there is togetherness in the occasion. So just what you're experiencing right now, bang, it's a whole bunch of things together. All right? In either case, there is the unique experiential togetherness. This is actually an extremely unusual claim of his. He's usually very careful to distinguish between what one can understand as actual occasions and societies, various forms, because they have different kind of existence. Actual occasions actually exist for him. Societies don't exist, not in the sense of existence that he's interested in. But in either case, you have experiential togetherness occurring. Now, I'll just say that in alluding, right, I'll repeat myself here, to a stream of experience, aside from alluding to James with that phrasing, Whitehead means what elsewhere he terms a society. Okay? I've already said that, so let's move. Okay. Now, here's Stengers. From a commentary she presented in 2006 to her own essay, Whitehead's Account of the Sixth Day, and we're talking about the Bible. I don't believe the commentary has ever been published, so I'm quoting from it here. Whitehead's project, she remarked, was not to explain societies, okay, to explain you, to your, or to explain us, or to explain the chair, okay? That's for scientists to do. That's not for Whitehead to do in his speculative philosophy, okay? It's not to explain societies, but to design abstractions that would give its full import to the extravagant empirical diversity we may discover when paying due attention both to what we call nature and to what we characterize as our experience. The whole point from Whitehead's perspective, as from James's perspective, is we live in an absolutely fecund, crazy world. That's the world as we wake up from deep sleep. We don't live in the world of high noon, except maybe the movie. Right. And so what he's interested in his speculative philosophy is speculating, on his part, to make speculation possible. And then to, that's the speculative part, and then the critical part is to criticize our abstractions so that they allow us to get a richer sense of the world which we experience. Now, back to Stengers. Societies may well not exist in metaphysical terms, but it is the very efficacy of what is metaphysically defined as existing actual occasions to defend this extravagant diversity against the misplaced concreteness of our explanatory abstractions. Fallacy of misplaced concreteness, very famous phrase of Whitehead's that has moved outside of his own domain. But again, I'll repeat this because this is the critical side, right? The speculation defends the diversity which, without critique, the abstractions end up ruinating in various ways. Indeed, this is Stengers again, the fact that societies are not res verae, real things, means that they have not the power to explain their own endurance. They cannot decide for themselves because they depend on the decision of what is actual. Part of what's involved in this perspective is that we have a lot less control over our lives than we think we do. We knew that. But this is actually an account of why that's the case. Because as societies, we just can't do certain things because we are, in a certain sense, controlled by forces not beyond us, but somehow that make us up. Right? But it's not a Freudian dark deep. It's a very different model. Societies, this is still Stengers, depend on the fact that actual entities, or actual occasions, they're for the most part the same thing, accept in their own becoming to conform to a common feature which other entities that they have to feel also accepted, also conformed to. So the whole point here, again, is sort of the amazing thing that each of your occasions of experience actually accepts the prior ones. All right, it's not forced to accept them is the point here. It actually goes along with it until it doesn't. And there are all kinds of ways in which it doesn't. I might not. Societies endure just as long as this thread of conformity is not broken. As a result, so that, for instance, when we walk out of here after this, one way it's not going to endure. I mean, there'll be various ways. There may be ways it can reformulate. We may find ourselves in a situation, it's very occasionally, rarely that is to say happens, but suddenly you have a group that feels itself has an identity as a group and wants to continue as that group, even though there's no reason to do that. And so finds a reason to do that, right? As a result, what matters for a society, the way it situates itself in its environment, has no justification transcending the empirical fact of the endurance of the society, and all our explanations depend on this fact. That's the end of the quote. Again, part of what's involved here is one thing that people never get if they haven't read Whitehead carefully, is that he's a strict rationalist who believes there's limits to rationalism. Okay? And this is what Stengers has just described. We are always dependent on the there's no justification transcending the empirical fact of the endurance of the society. There's no rational reason. That's what Russell is always looking for. Right? Russell is a fundamental rationalist with very little of an empiricist in his being. It's a very different sort of person than Whitehead. And here's Latour in his 2007 Manifesto Handbook, Reassembling the Social. This is the only place in that work where he engages Whitehead directly, though Whitehead is very, very important for him. Mostly because Whitehead is important for Stengers, and Stengers is super important for Latour. Quote, "In spite of the criticism I made earlier about the notion of society," most of this book is all about how the social is just not the way to go, "by opposition to what I proposed to call the collective, an even more radical solution would be to consider these bundles of actor networks in the same way that Whitehead considers the word society. For him, societies, remember this is all about togetherness, are not the assemblages of social ties in the way Durkheim or Weber would have imagined them, but are all the bundles of composite entities that endure in time and space. In his words, a society needs new associations in order to persist in its existence. And of course, such a labor requires the recruitment, mobilization, enrollment, and translation of many others, possibly of the whole universe. What is so striking in this generalized definition of society, as Latour continues, is that the respective meanings of subjectivity and objectivity are entirely reshuffled. Is a subject what is present? Is an object whatever was present? And the point being that there may be a subject and there are no humans, so long as there is something present. Right? That's the point. And similarly, the subject-object contrast becomes a temporal one. So every assemblage that pays the price of its existence in the hard currency of recruiting and extending is, or rather has, subjectivity. This is true of a body, of an institution, even of some historical event, which he also refers to as an organism. Subjectivity is not a property of human souls, but of the gathering itself, provided it lasts, of course. Here Latour properly stresses the quality of gathering in Whiteheadian togetherness. Quote, if we could retain this vastly expanded meaning of society, he adds, Latour adds, then we could again understand what Gabriel Tarde, another of his passions, meant when he said that everything is a society and that all things are society. Close quote. Okay, that's part three. Now, I'm sure this is a fairly difficult to gather together. It's substantial, but you don't have to ask me about what I talked about.
About the negative
preemptions. Negative preemptions, yes.
Is this similar to the Freudian repression?
No, not at all. Again, it's for one thing, it is entirely accessible. It is a much more genial mechanism. And in the same way as Freudian repression is very specific, and there is no sense in which you are repressing the entire universe, it would make no sense for Freud to make that claim. But that would be what the equivalent, that is, you would have to say you are repressing everything but the few things that you are, in fact, not repressing, as opposed to you are repressing a few things that end up dictating everything that you experience. So it's an inversion in many ways of the Freudian category. Yeah. As I say, much more benign, and that's related to Whitehead's invention of the term creativity. Okay, I'll go to the end, then we'll do it. Very good, very good. So the last section then is called Indication Cosmopolitics. And because I'm making the assumption that there's a certain amount of time constraint, I'm actually retaining the term indication here as a provocation. I don't plan to say anything about it unless I'm asked to. But there's, again, a very interesting story attached to it. Instead, I'm going to offer a few words about Stengers, whom I imagine is fairly unknown to most of the audience, and also give a couple of quotations characterizing her non-Kantian understanding of cosmopolitics. I've got a couple of other things we can talk about in reserve, but this will at least start off the final segment of our discussion. Stengers teaches philosophy, and that's, I assume some of you don't know much about her, and philosophy of the sciences at the Free University of Brussels. One of the major voices in science studies today, she is author and collaborator on many books, most recently, I believe, an edition with Latour of Étienne Suriot's The Different Modes of Existence, Les Différents Modes d'Existence, together with Suriot's brief essay on l'œuvre à faire, The Work to be Written, The Work to be Done. More expressly than most of us, and more intensely, I dare say, her practice is fundamentally one of collaboration. Beginning, and no doubt this is only one of several starting points, with her early work in the lab of Ilya Prigogine, the Belgian Nobel laureate best known for his investigations of dissipative structures and complex systems. And then continuing with, among many others, the ethnopsychiatrist Toby Nathan in their joint work Medicine and Sorcery, the psychoanalyst Léon Chartoc in a critique of psychoanalytic reason on hypnosis as a scientific problem from Lavoisier to Lacan, as well as with Gilles Deleuze and, of course, with Latour, none of these collaborations taking quite the same form as the others. In an essay titled Beyond Conversation, on the one hand, she's somebody who collaborates with everybody. On the other hand, she thinks conversation as an ideal is a silly ideal. She writes, quote, "I have called cosmopolitics the kind of experimental togetherness," there she's picking up Whitehead's phrase, "that makes peace a challenge and not the condition for a polite conversation." Obviously, this makes me a little self-conscious, right? We don't have to have a polite conversation here. To continue, quote, "Politics recalls," so in the term cosmopolitics, "politics recalls that this proposition stems from our Western tradition that linked what it abstracted as reason with what it invented as politics, which has meant, since Plato, the problem of who is entitled to speak and on what grounds when the question of our common destiny is at stake. The prefix cosmos, cosmopolitics, takes into account that the word common should not be restricted to our fellow humans, as politics since Plato has implied, but should entertain the problematic togetherness of the many concrete, heterogeneous, enduring shapes of value." And that's actually a quote from Whitehead in Science of the Modern World, "that compose actuality, thus including beings as disparate," this is Stenger's, "as neutrinos, a part of the physicist's reality, and ancestors, a part of reality for those whose traditions have taught them to communicate with the dead." Close quote. And here, so that's all under the rubric of what she's trying to propose, and it is a proposition which she wants to see what will happen as a lure for feeling. And here's how Latour characterizes Stenger's sense of cosmopolitics. It's not quite the same, and so it's interesting to hear that. Quote, "A Stoic or a Kantian will call cosmopolitan anyone who is a citizen of the cosmos, rather than or before he or she is a citizen of a particular state, an adherent of a particular religion, a member of a particular guild, profession, or family." Stenger's intends her use of cosmopolitics to alter what it means to belong or to pertain. She has reinvented the word by representing it as a composite of the strongest meaning of cosmos and the strongest meaning of politics, precisely because the usual meaning of the word cosmopolite supposed a certain theory of science that is now disputed. So for both Stenger's, we haven't gotten into this here, and Latour, and this is again, as I say, related very much to why James and Whitehead emerge as and when they do, it is no longer possible or preferable to divorce philosophy from science, which is not to say that philosophy needs to be the helpmate of science. So part of, again, I'll just say that one of the real questions that this work raises is how so little of modern philosophical thought and contemporary philosophical thought has any engagement whatsoever with the sciences. You know, I mean, yes, Zizek is a brilliant quick study, so he will go read a book by Antonio Damasio and bring it into, but the Damasio, I can assure you, is already much mediated, and not nearly the whole story of whatever it is he's talking about, right? So it's a complicated question as to the kind of theory that is being worked. On the one hand, it is very overly critical in some ways. as a self-description. And on the other hand, it isn't wide-ranging enough, perhaps. And that's what these various figures suggest. So the composite of these two terms, or the strongest meaning, he says, of these two terms, because the usual meaning of the word cosmopolite, as proposed by Kant, supposed a certain theory of science that is now disputed. For Stengers as well as for me, Latour adds in a footnote, the ability to imagine a political order is always directly predicated on a certain definition of science. This link has been forcibly made by science studies. The main weakness of legal and humanitarian forms of cosmopolitanism is to forget entirely the theory of science that has been surreptitiously used to assemble the cosmos in a peaceful manner. In other words, you're talking about the world, and you're talking about the world as it's understood through scientific means, right? Assemble the cosmos in a peaceful manner, but without due process, as it were. Then Latour continues. For Stengers, the strength of one element checks any dulling in the strength of the other, cosmos and politics. The presence of cosmos in cosmopolitics resists the tendency of politics to mean the give and take in an exclusive human club. The presence of politics in cosmopolitics resists the tendency of cosmos to mean a finite list of entities that must be taken into account. Cosmos protects against the premature closure of politics, and politics against the premature closure of cosmos. For the Stoics, he concludes, cosmopolitanism was a proof of tolerance. Cosmopolitics, in Stenger's definition, is a cure for what she calls the malady of tolerance. And I'll close quote there, and that's where I'll stop on this high note of speculative critique. The malady of tolerance. So, thank you. You have one more opportunity to throw a bomb in my direction, something to unnerve me, and either make me... I'm happy to be asked a question that I have no answer to. Those are the most interesting questions, ultimately. Please...
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in this moment that we're all living in right now that speaks a lot to the points you're making here, and in the notion of speculative conceptions of what the world will be or can be, because we have now this opportunity of all these various cultures now contributing to that dialogue in ways that didn't exist historically on this planet. And so we all talk about it, and we all build things together that way. And so I'm concerned with the idea of how to maintain the difference in what might be a drive towards a center. In other words, the destructive thing against the opportunity that we have now is that we come to a concordance. And we stop having all these speculations.
Yeah, and that's again precisely what Stengers is resisting with her notion of cosmopolitics. Another way to think about it, because you use the phrase the present moment, which is of course how we tend to talk about the present moment. One of the things that I've been struck by, and that is central to the investigation that I do with a range of figures in different disciplines, is that both Whitehead and James actually have very specific speculative instruments, which is a phrase of I. Richards, though he meant it in a more rigid sense than I would. And so that, for instance, there's I've been reading recently a couple of books by a guy named John McCumber, who's a a guy who teaches in German at UCLA, but he's a philosopher who was trained as a philosopher and ended up in a German department because American philosophy was so rigid. And he's been writing about, invariably about the philosophy of time. He has very interesting things to say. It's very much a sort of Hegelian, Heideggerian narrative that he proposes. Absolutely no sense of this alternative narrative. And what his account of the philosophy of time entirely misses is this sort of thing. One of the things that James is known for is the introduction of the concept of the specious present. Some of you have heard of it, some of you haven't, but he took the phrase from another figure, and he only uses it in the Principle of Psychology, never used it again. But the phrase took on a life of its own, and throughout the middle of the 20th century was a sort of dominant figure for the present moment, as it were. What is confusing about the phrase is that James meant by it actually something very different from what it seems to mean. The phrase in itself was initially devised in order to mean that our sense of the present is specious, right? That the present is always falling, it's the old Augustinian trope, but the present is always no longer there when we look for it. It's suddenly, whatever was present now is past, and the future has turned present, but when we look at that, it's always past. We never actually can grasp the present. James's argument was that this thing he called the specious present actually did exist, but it always had a sort of durative quality. What he described as it's not a knife edge present, it's a saddleback present. There's always an element in it in which one is looking forward to something in the future. There's a piece of the future is actually in the present, and a piece of the past is actually in the past, the just past. We still have. Now, the interesting thing, as James elaborated this concept and ceased to use the phrase specious present and spoke more in terms of saddleback present or actual present and such, but it's a term that is what he, all the later work of his is still sort of generally discussed under this notion, it ends up being a very different model of time than any of the figures in McCumber's Germanist tradition have any way of grasping, because it's a new concept in the Deleuzian sense. And so it's that kind of a work which is actually designed to multiply the sorts of the differences in experience rather than to homogenize them into this present that's never there. It's all the same. That these figures are actually interested in devising and that have empirical, so that what one can show is that once you start working with this concept, you can find and locate and work with material that is within a rigid empiricist framework just is not there. So.
A question that was brought to me by my reading a long time ago of a book. I think you quoted by Kadlec, the book on modernism, on pragmatist modernism by Kadlec. You may know him, who has something on James and a sort of radical anarchism. That's how he sees the later James as moving towards an individualism that would be almost anarchist in a political sense. It seems to me that Whitehead is using a similar starting point to stress the opposite idea somehow with togetherness. Something of the...
No,
I mean by Kadlec? You know...
Who is it again?
Mosaic modernism.
Mosaic modernism.
Yeah. It shows that it is.
I don't know. What is his name?
K A D L E C. Okay. He died very young.
Yeah. I know the name. I don't know the book.
Did this one book, which takes James as the key philosopher of modernism, since some of us work on modernism and so on. But his point is that at the end of the 19th century, a number of philosophers, James above all, we're really interested in the less violent forms modes of anarchism, yeah. of, anarchism right. Kropotkin, mm-hmm. not Bakunin, and right. so on.
And yeah, in James's own terms, he speaks of democracy, chiefly rather than anarchism. But I think where Whitehead and James overlap in this regard is that they are extraordinarily interesting pluralists. This is one of the reasons why, for instance, when Russell interpreted James as being a neutral monist like himself, how off base he was. Because for James, you basically have a pluriverse, and there is no sense in, and I see why you're thinking Whitehead is different, there's no way in which it all fits together. You only basically have local pieces of it that fit together, but the whole thing as a whole, that's an idealist notion or rationalist notion, that's Bradley, that's the absolute. Now, in Whitehead's case, that's only true if you don't think about negative prehension. It's negative prehension that actually allows Whitehead to describe exactly the same set of circumstances that James is describing in his pluralism. All right? Because he's not talking about conscious of the whole universe. And it can be any number of indirections, and you're basically working off of what happened just before. It's all kinds of implicatory factors. But there's absolutely, the whole point of it is that there is no grasping the universe as a whole. But any occasion only grasps a very limited subset of the universe. And that is obviously related to anarchistic conceptions, where, again, you are resisting to the dying breath the imposition on you, variously. Although it's not nihilist, right? And I don't think that Whitehead is the opposite, but he can appear to be the opposite because he insists on talking about the universe as a whole, the cosmos. But it's really as a challenge, which one shouldn't give up too lightly, I think, is the claim that's being made there by Stengers. Because, in fact, if you give up the cosmos, you don't have to pay any attention to all the things you're not paying attention to. Right. Yes?
I don't mean this in a negative sort of way. I really like this work, and I read James a long time ago, and a lot of this stuff that's been coming out lately on James and Whitehead's really exciting to me. But I remember I picked up, I didn't make it through the whole book, Stephen Shaviro's Kant, Whitehead, Deleuze, and he starts with this gesture that I hear a bit in what you're saying now of, since we read Heidegger, we wound up with this set of questions, and if we'd just been smarter and read Whitehead, we would have had these better questions. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's the sort of theory of intellectual history that I'm curious about, because it seems to me that if you're reading Heidegger well, you're also reading Bergson, and if you're reading Bergson, then you're already pretty close to some ideas in James. Mm-hmm. Or maybe you have Kierkegaard, and then you have a concept of the present age that doesn't seem so far. And if you're reading Kojève, then you also have Thruval, you have all the American philosophers standing behind him, and all sorts of other international circuits. Mm-hmm. So I don't have an entirely posed question, but it seems like if we read well, we'll come, and maybe this is when you said you're almost a Rodian, mm-hmm. as a sort of question of we need a certain set of vocabulary, but it seems that, I'm not sure my question, but something that there's a robust, to borrow your term, there's a robust way of reading figures that allows us to make these sort of connections. And I do appreciate the sort of uncovering, mm-hmm. I think, yeah.
Let me paraphrase what you're saying, sure. And you can tell me if this is accurate, and then I'll know I can respond to it. Yeah. What you're suggesting is that if we read carefully enough, many of the figures in the last two centuries will be able to come to much of what's important in figures like James and Whitehead. As we could do if we just read James and Whitehead, we would be able to come to what's important in other figures. And that's, of course, true. The issue here is, are there distinctive things about different philosophers? There's enormous overlap. But one of the questions, I mean, it's a really important question, because one of the things that pretty much everybody does when they do intellectual history is they're talking about likenesses. And they're saying there's a genealogy here, and, you know, I'm lured by X and I'm lured by Y, and I see the same thing in both of them, and isn't that fantastic? There's a real community being formed and all this. And so that's all totally legitimate, okay? I'm not the least bit interested in saying don't do that. But at the same time, that kind of community formation can, in fact, turn out to be a consensus conversation, okay, where one ends up, in fact, having everybody say the same thing and missing what is different in these figures. So that, for example, what I've been struck by, I've been working the last couple of years, I'm not a native-born Deleuzian by any means, but I've been reading a lot of him, and very carefully, for two reasons. One, because he does say a few nice things about Whitehead, so hey, you know, where's that from, what's that about? And he's also this interesting nexus with Bergson, and obviously there is some connection between Bergson and Whitehead. I mean, Bergson and James, as is also only Whitehead, but they're different. But chiefly, I'm interested in it because for Stengers narrates her career as a philosopher as she was pulled into philosophy by the near simultaneous, here she was this science person who was also a science studies person in the making, but she was pulled into philosophy 30 years ago when she read simultaneously Deleuze and Whitehead. And she's continued to work and mine the two of them, understanding for her that they're not the same person. And for her, the significance that they possess for her is, in fact, that they are not simply the same person, but they give her different tools, right? So that's one of the things, which is to read people who are clearly related to each other, but actually provide one with extremely different tools. But so I was reading Deleuze for that. But also to help me better understand Bergson. And specifically, what I take to be a real problem, which is that Bergson said, James, he's my brother. James said, Bergson, he's my brother. Therefore, everybody says, they're so similar. They're not. They're hugely different. To give you one example, James's Darwinism is not Bergson's Darwinism. Bergson's Darwinism is worthy of a Nobel Prize, but not necessarily very useful scientifically, precisely because he has no concept of the moment. None whatsoever. James has this incredibly imaginative concept, which then Whitehead picks up and runs with. It's not there in Bergson, and conceptually, it's not there in Deleuze. Deleuze gives us all kinds of insight into momentary experience, but he doesn't have the vocabulary for it. So you can derive it from Deleuze because you know James, but you actually can't do as much with it just from Deleuze. So that's the kind of thing that I'm interested in. So it's not just simply everybody stop reading Heidegger, stop reading Deleuze, stop reading Bergson, and just read my guys. Okay? It's that if you think you're just going to find more of the same, you're not. And it's up to you whether you find this interesting enough to go and take a look. Many people do not, for extremely bad reasons.
some of them may not for extremely good reasons. Okay, I tend to focus on the bad reasons because I do want these folks to be read more, and I think there are very bad reasons why they haven't been. But your point is well taken. It really is. Okay.
Convince us.
There's this interesting line out of Stengers and Latour, and it's fascinating that, there's actually a really good group of Whiteheadians on the West Coast, and there's a little group of them in England who are they're in conversation with Stengers, but they're not Stengers acolytes, and so there is now, I believe, actually a kind of enough work being done that it's actually got substance. But that's to some degree that's Stengers. I should say, by the way, if you open Process of Reality and it really seems impenetrable, which it may, before you give up entirely, you should look at Stengers' book called Thinking with Whitehead, which was recently translated into English and came out from Harvard. And it's basically a third of it is just quotes from Whitehead that she's carefully assembled in his work from the early 20s to the late 20s, and then commentary both about what he is doing and her understanding of how it can be applied to the present moment. Seems to me an extraordinarily productive engagement. And much easier in a certain way to grasp than going full hog into the Whitehead itself. Which, again, you have to recognize, Whitehead as a philosopher is very peculiar. He's not trained. He's not interested in disciples. He's not interested in anybody but himself. And he's not the author of his books. He is grabbed, taken up by this project. And Stengers is very clear about how that works. He finds things out along the way, as we all do. But he makes that of the essence of what he's doing. Thank you all, really. Thank you for the opportunity.